But now
I feel like there's a lot to unpack from just that statement.
Listen up, Umi. This is a podcast with the most Tucker. This is Forge the Narrative.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul, your host. I'm joined by Adam Camilleri.
Oh, hello, everybody.
And Tanya Gates.
Hey, everybody.
Welcome. We are the Bell Lost Souls podcast. Red may be joining us later also, trying to get back here to our normal, it's not even our normal recording time. We actually talk about 40K all night. I love it.
It's a hard life.
I do want to mention the Shadow's Edge Miniatures Kickstarter we've been talking about. They've crested, they're almost at $11,000. By the time you hear this, it might actually be $11,000 with almost 100 people backing them. Check them out if you haven't already. It's one of some of these products that I, again, use and believe in. And it's a cool way to support a cool company and get some stuff in the process. I'll put the link in the show notes if you have not checked it out already. I'm sure they would appreciate you at least looking at what they have going on. But I think it's pretty cool to see this be successful throughout the whole campaign. Mm. Tufts, weathering powders, some other things, you know, get them while it's hot. So what we were just talking about was how we're talking on the Thursday show. And look, I know how difficult it is to find the Thursday show. I will try to throw some links. Yeah. Well, it's, you know, look, I try to put some links in the show notes. People can find that as well. But it's one of the things we talk about it. And actually, in the middle of this show, I'll put in a little piece of hype where myself and Nick talk about 2 or 3 minutes about what we have going on. And also, we talk about the Art of War Down Under podcast, Mr. Camilleri.
Ooh, nice.
Yeah.
Lovely.
Getting all the plugs in early. Enthusiasm is a kind of a palate cleanser in the middle of the show. But what we're just talking about is that the meta is all over the place.
It is a brand new world. It is so wide open. You can pretty much play anything. My best advice would be to start with a single detachment of something and then work your way into the new meta from there. Like just small iterations, fill your way through it. It's such a big change, it's hard to know where to start. So my best advice is just pick a detachment and start.
Let me define what I mean by the meta is all over the place. The meta, I know it's one of those things that's like, oh, talking about what's hot at tournaments or whatever. And that has something to do with it. But what has opened it up is that there's been changes to the secondaries, like fundamental changes to the secondaries in missions that of how the game is scored, which means automatically that certain units are either more or less valuable to the game state than they were, you know, pre-Nephilim. And then there's just points changes. So certain armies that were maybe, you know, needed to be balanced are now, you know, 400 points over 2,000. And certain armies, like Death Guard, are basically getting like 300 or 400 points more than they would have before. So I'm not saying that automatically makes them good or to the top of the food chain or anything like that, but things have shifted to where there are more options out there for people to brew and build lists.
Absolutely. It's not a, the slate of the whole meta hasn't been wiped clean. Like there's some armies that are still good, are still very good. You know, Tyranids is a great example, but where they've seen the fundamental rebalance is they haven't just tried to rebalance the game around points and the viability of different units. They've tried to rebalance the game around, the army's interaction with the mission. So they've done that by completely revamping the secondaries and by unencumbering the amount of faction secondaries you can take.
I didn't expect that. But what we've seen is something like the Adeptus Sororitas, who have 3 really attainable secondaries.
Yeah.
You know, does that make them more viable?
Absolutely. And this is a competitive term, I guess. We always talk about the scoring ability of an army list or a faction having a floor and a ceiling. And it's not, it doesn't necessarily, the better army doesn't necessarily is the one with the highest ceiling. It's usually the one with the highest floor, as in the highest minimum amount of points you can score reliably. And so if you look at it like that, like having those reliable sister secondaries just means you have a very high floor of predicted outcome. Like, so even if you do, say, lose a game, you get an exceptionally good score leaving it.
Well, last would almost work in that fashion. Like, it would pad points.
Yeah.
Like you can go into it, and like, I've got these 15, and then you took another secondary. Mm-hmm. Like, well, I've got these 15, and of course, I'll score a couple of primaries along the way. So worst I'm coming out of this game is 44 points or something.
Exactly right. And that's a perfect example of a reason why To the Last was a little bit too good, because it was just ubiquitous. It was just like everyone took it. It made for very stale games because both players took it and then refused to use their best units or whatnot. It's crazy amount of change has been brought into this here game. I'm wondering if Age of Sigmar has seen the similar revamp in their General's Handbook.
Yes. So I actually just got my General's Handbook yesterday and started going through it. And I think that it's going to change things up a lot. So in Age of Sigmar, they have battle tactics instead of secondaries, but they kind of work the same way. And in the new General's Handbook, this, battle tactics are a lot more difficult to get. And I'm not mad about it because I feel like it was a little bit too easy in the last General's Handbook. And it was also, like, sometimes when they're too easy to achieve, it makes it a little bit difficult to try and stop your opponent from achieving them, if that makes sense. So sometimes it just felt a little bit, like, non-interactive in that way. Like, you couldn't really stop it from happening. And I think, like, having that agency to interact with your opponent scoring points is what makes the game kind of fun. So I haven't played any of the new missions with the new, the missions are also, they seem fantastic. I haven't had the chance to play them yet, but I'm going to play my first game on Saturday, and I'm just super excited to try it all out.
Yeah, so you're talking about you were worried there before it was just kind of cheapening the decision making a little bit too much because it felt like no matter what you did, people were gonna get their scores. I like that a lot. Yeah, I like that a lot if they've mixed that up.
Yeah, and then it's hard to explain, but the focus, there's like a focus in each of these General's Handbooks. So the last General's Handbook, the focus was on monsters. So if you achieved your battle tactics with monsters or you killed a monster, you got extra points. So now that doesn't exist anymore, but now you can get extra points if you have basically battle line units that are under 4 wounds and don't have a mount. So if you have those, they call them, I don't know how to pronounce it. I'm going to butcher it, I'm sure. But they call them Galician veterans, and they're kind of the, well, it would seem that they intended for these battle line units to be sort of the focus of this General's Handbook. But I have a feeling that it's actually going to be maybe opposite, and some factions are going to go away from small battle line units. Like, for example, my ogres, I don't think I'm going to run battle line units, the Galician veteran as battle line units, because there's a new detachment that essentially gives your troops like an extra wound when they go into those Galician. Wow, okay. Or, yep. Like, an extra damage when you go into that unit. So I think you could go either way. I think if you're a horde-based army, you're really going to lean into the Galician veterans because they count as more models on objectives. But if you're more elite, you might want to go away from that and just, like, beef up some units to just really take out those veterans. So it's going to be interesting to see how different factions play it. It's kind of how I feel it's going to go, but I'm not 100% sure.
It almost felt like there you were discussing the pros and cons of like MSU versus more medium-sized units versus more elite-style armies, which is cool. Awesome.
Yeah.
Things are shaking up.
Yeah, like take it with a grain of salt here because like I'm fairly new to this game, but I really have a feeling that that things are going to really be spicy with Age of Sigmar coming up. Yeah.
We're liking the spice on this show.
No, that's good. I mean, look, this is getting more things on the tabletop. And when things do become stale, where people are kind of feel like they're disincentivized to get out and participate because they're going to meet XYZ list, and it is wide open, I think, across both core games at this moment.
I have a question about the GT pack. Did they change the missions at all, or are the missions the same in this one?
Missions are the same.
Yeah, missions is it's really just the secondaries that that have altered that, and then but it's how it interacts with the missions. But at the same time, I like a kind of a standard or a comfortable mission format.
That could be the cycle. We're getting 6 monthly revamps here on General's Handbook and Chapter Approved, maybe it's every 6 months they redo the secondaries, and then every 6 months they redo the primary missions. So, you know, we have stable secondaries for 12 months on a different cycle, and we have stable primary missions on a 12-month cycle on a different 6 months. So that would be cool. That would just be a little way just to keep things a little bit fresher between.
Mm-hmm. That would be good. You know, and I'm back into like, man, what do I take for secondaries? What am I doing?
Yeah. Yeah. Impactful decisions. I love it.
Yeah. And I honestly, you know, I feel like I've picked two solid ones, and then the third one's always just a crapshoot.
that's pretty much the case.
But it's one of those is like, do I have models left? If I have models left in like turn five, I'm probably winning. If I don't, I've lost.
Mm-hmm. So that tends to be the Blood Angels, you know, way of life, right?
Yeah. So it's basically, it's like, okay, well, does this third one even matter? Because it's not going to be close one way or the other.
Yeah. Yeah. I get you.
But I do like the Blood Angel secondary, to where you basically just have to have more units. Well, it's not basically. You do have to have more units in your opponent's deployment zone than they have in yours.
Yeah, very straightforward and very accomplishable for probably two or three turns of the game.
Yeah. Well, even then, it's like you just kind of choke that side of the table to where they have to keep diverting units into it. And if they somehow don't have to do that, things have gone incredibly poorly for you. And that's what I was talking about.
And you're bigger fish to fry.
Yeah,
most likely your own fish are fried.
Yeah, my own fish are fried. I'm trying to figure out how to figure out what killed 27
all these fish
yard with five assault intercessors.
Oof.
I managed this ecosystem very poorly. Exactly. All the fish are gone.
It's a bad deal. But I do want to talk about, so this is with changes like Dove at the moment, and you know, maybe the outcome of whether or not we're going to see a lot of psychers and stuff. I'm really kind of hemming and hawing of, you know, with the list that I'm taking to support this kind of big forward push, what third HQ do I take? Because Sanguinary Priest is kind of like a must have.
Yep.
Dante, not necessarily an auto include, but I do really like the fact that he gets you an extra warlord. I'm sorry, an extra command point, and like mimics some of the things you might spend command points on. He also gets his heroic deed stratagem for free.
Yep. Well, so it's interesting that you're having this discussion, because for a lot of people, this is going to be a very real change. Can I justify a third HQ? Can I justify a third character? Are my characters good enough on the data sheet that they don't need warlord traits and relics? Because, you know, that's another lessening of the decision choice, I guess. If your character is just good enough all the time, you don't need to give them warlord traits and relics in order for them to make their value, you know? So like Dante is a great example. And I think this is why we might start to see a lot more special characters start making the cut, which has definitely not been the case for 9th edition so far, because, well, actually 8th edition was even where we saw one of the discrepancies start to build. Like, you talk about Dante in 8th edition, yeah? And then you talk about what you could do with just a captain with a Thunderhammer, and you're like, wow.
Ben Guineas. All day long, give me two or three of them.
Exactly
don't need Dante.
Dante didn't hold a candle to that stuff. Whereas now, a lot of the time, the value of the unit is on the data sheet. And G-Dub's done a great job of retaining the value of the unit just being where it lies in the codex.
I mean, he's got permanent lightning fast reactions. I mean, so got a lot going for him right on the data sheet. So
he brings you one CP for being warlord, and then he makes a significant use stratagem for him personally free. So he can bring you like 3 CP of value, really.
Yeah. I know we're talking about Dante specifically, but I think this is one of the decision points of if you have a character in your, you know, codex that you can take that has these types of qualities and you weren't considering them before, maybe it's time to check them out again.
Yeah, that's exactly my point, I think. Fresh eyes on all your characters. I've never taken Samael. In fact, I don't even have a proper Samael model. I've got a couple of conversions that I used to use, but you know, when you can still have him on the land speeder. Mm-hmm. But now, like, the difference, Samael is 10 points more expensive than a captain on a bike who has the chapter master upgrade. And for those 10 points, he comes with a double storm bolter, a plasma cannon that doesn't overheat, and essentially a power fist in the form of a Rend 4 Stormbolter. So a super power fist, because on the charge, he's strength times 2. And so he gets all that extra value. And sorry, and one more pip of movement, a couple more wounds. Like, that's the 10-point difference. And he doesn't need a Wall of Trait, doesn't need a Relic, because he already has, like, 3, essentially. And all of a sudden, he's a phenomenal piece of tech. He's a phenomenal character. So, and I think there's a lot of those there for everybody. You know, Shadow Sun jumps to mind for Tau. Typhus jumps to mind in some specific builds for Death Guard. I mean, Ahriman's already ubiquitous for T-Suns. There's so many special characters out there that are going to get a whole new lease on life.
I don't mind it. One of those situations to where we now have a scarcity issue with command points, and that is causing us to figure out how to solve that problem if it matters. I mean, there's some armies that are less thirsty for command points.
Is it weird that I approached these changes with some trepidation, but now I am really excited? Did anybody else echo that? Like, or heard any of their mates that's just like, yeah, I'm not sure about this one?
We say this all the time. No one likes to be changed, period. And everyone is being changed, though, so there's some comfort in that.
That is true. Yeah, there's some comfort in it to just be like, well, it's not just me, at least.
But we're brewers. You know, we are list builders, and this is an opportunity to get in there and tinker around, tool around, figure out whose tech is best.
Yeah, but we're not fishermen, because we let all the fish die. It's bad.
We've seen how it's about controlling the pace in which the fish die.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
And sometimes that goes horribly wrong.
Sustainable fish farming practices is what we promote on Forge of Narrative.
Oh, man, I'm telling you, when you put, you know, 30 gold-armored fish into a tank, you think they're going to survive, and then you end up losing them all by turn 2.
What happens when you have all Adam, no red? Just get all the metaphors.
But you know, back on the list specifically, though, is it right now, because the way, like, when you put a banner in there, and I'm actually going with the relic on the banner to give him the icon of the angel, which lets him reroll charges.
Yep.
Because I'm going over there anyway. I want to try to go over there as reliable as possible. Then, do you even need a chaplain? And then it's a question if you don't need a chaplain, should I be taking a librarian? Because it opens up a secondary option for me. If there are no good secondaries, then I have a couple of, you know, kind of easy to achieve psychic secondaries.
Yeah, I agree with that. And also, I think it's a little bit of an underrated choice for Blood Angels, the psychic secondaries, especially what's the one we do in the middle of the table? Ritual?
Psychic ritual.
So you want to tell me you're going to blob up 21 Sangard around a Libby in the middle of the table, and your opponent has to come within 24 to stop you. Huh. It's a bad choice.
It's like the psychic interrogation, too, which is the other side of that, which you have to get within, you know, 24 inches of a character, cast it on a 4, what I think it's a 4 or something like that. And I know we're talking about Blood Angels and like the list I'm crafting specifically, but I think this is a question for Marine players of when should you take that one librarian, and is the secondary option enough to push you to take it?
Well, there's also that same question is there for a bunch of different armies at the moment. I think even Eldar might be coming to the same realization. I mean, Eldritch Storm got quite a bit of a rework, and I don't think it's where the value is now. So taking your 2-3 Farseers, especially if you're taking a single detachment, might not always be the way to go. So, and then if you only take one or, say, 2 Farseers, can you afford to have one dedicated to just getting you psychic secondary points, not casting your Jinx and your Quicken and things like that? So there is a lot of that there for people. Can you afford to do so? Do you have good enough psychic powers intrinsically that one of these is valuable? And are they valuable by themselves without a Wall of Trait or a Relic? And if they are, can you afford to, is your game plan strong enough that you can afford to not use them to do psychic secondaries?
Yeah, it's a tough call.
Yeah, it's a very tough call. Yeah, huge.
So I've gone to forsake that and put in the Sanguiner.
I think, yeah, totally fine.
Sanguiner's in that sweet spot. He's 150 points. Same points as a primary chaplain on a bike.
Yep.
Comparable points to a librarian. Mm-hmm. And he also gets some tricks.
Undeniable jank.
Yeah. I don't think I don't think we're at the stage of the game where you're ever going to catch anyone, you know, out with the Sanguiner's special ability. He has an ability to heroically intervene from off the table.
Yeah.
So
I don't know if people are aware of a certain stratagem that then ensues following that, but it's pretty impactful.
You can then, you know, basically make everyone attack him after he swoops in. Is that what you're talking about? You're talking about something else.
Yeah, Angel Sacrifice.
Yeah, Angel Sacrifice. Yeah.
So he essentially will just flip a combat. Every time he comes down, he'll change you like, oh, cool, I'm going to charge his Sanguinary Guard or Death Company or whatever, and I'm going to win that combat. And then the Sanguinary comes in and says no.
Yeah, swoops in and said, okay, I know that you had this big, powerful unit, but now everyone in that unit has to attack this guy that wasn't there before. And then you might not kill him. You probably will.
It's true.
Yeah, he's not incredibly durable. But I don't want to get too far deep into the Blood Angel tech, but it really is a choice of, like, is a chaplain required, you know, in this day and age, if you can supplement it with characters you weren't necessarily taking before because they gave you some other benefits? And then is a librarian an option? Things like Null Zone, if you're a Marine player, don't count it out.
Yeah, for sure.
And what then the secondaries, how points? How do you actually win the game once you start engaging with the opponent?
Question for you, Tanya. How many secondaries are there in the General's Handbook? Is there we saw a bunch of generic secondaries go away in the 40K chapter approved, and now our secondary objectives are pretty minimal generic wise, but there is just an absolute godload of them available to the faction ones. Sorry, because it used to be
I think that there's like 8 or 9 generic ones, something like that. You can only pick each one once per game. So yeah, I think there's about 8 or 9. They are a lot more difficult to actually get. And then if you have a third edition codex, you'll have a few in there as well. From what I've seen, the majority of them are just very like narrative and fluffy, and you're probably going to be sticking to the ones in the General's Handbook anyway. But yeah, there's definitely not as many to choose from as there are in 40K, but I think like in general, almost all factions can do most of them. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure that I don't think we need as many, to be honest, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who needs them? Points overrated.
Well, I mean, what we got to be asking ourselves though is like, how do we, like, it's cool to have the complexity of the list and the points changes, which, by the way, that's not sarcasm. It is cool to have to have another opportunity to go back in the box and the think tank and figure out what to take. But now we're also talking about like how to get more than 50 points in a game.
True. I mean, well, if you this rabbit hole goes as deep as you want to go. You could even go to the rabbit hole and just be like, well, what armies is my faction weak against, or what armies are going to be really good in the new game? Do I predict? And then be like, look at their best secondary options, and then be like, okay, so they're gonna, on average, they will get 65 points, you know, without doing nothing, just standing there in the breeze, they'll get 65 points. So my plan needs to be at least worth 66 points. You know,
it's a good way of thinking about it.
That you can go that deep with this if you really want to, and by all means, you do not have to.
So it's not like reading the first half of the secondary and know there's more words there. Be like, I'll just figure it out when the game starts. That's not the best way of doing it.
No, not always.
Oh darn, that's what I was doing wrong. Whoops.
Yeah, I won't say anything bad about Age of Sigmar, but 40K is only getting deeper. Scoring wise and stuff like that, I think our lists are getting more homogenous. Like, you know, the fact that a lot of the soup and a lot of the allies choices that are factors that make it very hard for Games Workshop to balance this game are starting to be wholly de-incentivized. Like, you lose mono faction bonuses, you lose access to your amazing secondary suite now if you, you know, were to soup or all those things. And so there's really very, very few reasons to want to break your faction. And so it's just, and while I think we're losing some flavor because we're missing that, it's making the game a lot easier for GW to manage. Remember, a couple of months ago, I was just like, I really don't envy Games Workshop in their role. I know us, all the armchair generals, sit back and be like, oh, I could balance this better. Blah, blah, blah,
give me 10 minutes and a napkin.
Yeah, exactly right. And then you realize that there's 22 factions and each faction has like somewhere between 15 and 90 different units, and all those units have different war gear options, and you're like, yeah, why did I think I could do this? And then all those armies have different stratagems and war traits and relics and psychic powers and litanies and secondaries, and you're like, yeah, okay, well, I'm okay if they take away some factors. If they just, I'm okay if to play using air quotes here, the competitive matched play game in a defined sandbox, you know, if that means that it's easy for GW to get the game into a place where everyone's got a chance.
Yeah. I feel like we're kind of close. I don't know that I don't know if ultimately we'll look back and say the command point hit helped us, you know, like on the fun side. But once we start playing the games, it might be what it is. I mean, you got to get a lot pickier and choosier, and things that can be done every turn of the game might not get done every turn of the game.
Yeah. So when you guys think about a game of 40K or Age of Sigmar or whatever game you play, do you know which is your favorite part of the game? I talk to some people I know, but do you have a specific turn? Like top of turn two, when I go first as Blood Angels, I'm in my prime because, you know, that's the go turn. That's the send them all in turn. Whereas for me, my favorite turns are the turns four and turns five, usually turn five. If I can get to turn five and the game is still in the balance, And my decisions and my opponent's decisions, my spending of command points, every phase is going to matter, helps determine, like, changes who wins and who loses that game. That is the peak enjoyment that I get from 40K.
It's right, or any game for that matter. We rolled to see who goes first.
Well, for some people, I know mates who are deep analysts of the game, and their funnest part is in list creation. They love designing lists, crafting thematic lists that, you know, speak to them in the way they want to play the game, and trying to get the nuts over their opponent or their rival because they take this piece or that piece or that piece or whatever.
I really dig that mode too. It's like when you show up and you anticipate what the meta is going to be, and you've got just that perfect counter,
and you hit it just plumb. It's so good.
And then it lines up to where you actually get to play what you were planning on facing.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't always work out that way. Sometimes you have the perfect answer to the questions that were never asked on that day.
Yes.
You know,
perfect example. I went to a 100 player event a couple of weeks ago, and I teched my list specifically to have a good matchup into Eldar, an okay match into Tyranids. And that meant that no matter what, I had an awful matchup into Tau. Guess what? I beat Harlequins, I beat Drakari, got smashed, beat Tyranids, annihilated by Tau. 2 out of 3, eh? You know, I'll call that a success.
Let's take a quick break right here. We'll come back. We'll find Red in the middle of this break. Don't forget, it's going to have a quick word from Nick Nottavati and myself, and then we'll be back with the crew. See you in a minute.
FTN is brought to you by Discount Games Inc. Please visit them at www.discountgamesinc.com. And don't forget to ask Jay about ways to save even more on your hobby projects.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to a very special, I guess, player spotlight, but we're the players?
I guess so. Whatever you want to call it.
I'm Paul Murphy. This is Nick Nottavati.
And it's time to party.
Let's do it. Look, I'm very excited. I want to talk about some of the things that we've been doing. You know, people have heard me talk about, like, the Thursday show that Adam and I do, and they've heard me mention that been doing some Art of War stuff with you. And so I thought, why not get people on, introduce you to people that, you know, may not be familiar if they aren't familiar.
Yeah, and I'd love to meet your audience and all that. That sounds awesome.
Over there, it's a two-part show. In the first part of the show, we talk to, like, recent tournament winners, like people that have done really well or won a tournament that past weekend. So real fresh, you know, off of their victory. And we kind of pick their brain about, like, what stratagems they use a lot, what secondaries they pick, how they got their victory, and, you know, a little bit about what list they were taking.
Yeah. And then in part two, we go through each individual matchup. So approach it like, how did you actually pilot your Tau or your Eldar or your Tyranids into these different armies and claim victory over all the other top dogs in the game? And we'll even try to get some more esoteric offbeat armies too. We just had orcs on a few weeks ago talking about how they can go fight the Tyranid metas and do surprisingly well.
I think we're going to have, like, meta, like, what is the meta, and then meta busters from time to time. So really encourage people to check it out. Plus, look, we get, like, really kind of deep in the weeds in some of these things in a good way, like really breaking down why a unit works a certain way with a certain stratagem, and then how do you get successful with that?
One of the things I love working with you about, Paul, is that you have such a great way of breaking down those high-level technical plays down to a level that most people can understand, whereas, like, some competitive players like myself, we can get lost in the sauce. And I think what we do together is we bring the yin and the yang, the peanut butter and the jelly, and we bring it together for all of you wonderful people.
Yeah, instead of hearing us just jibber-jabber, there's actually someone who's you know, done it, like, right there on the cast with us, and it's really been fun I've learned a lot myself doing it. It's been fun to do and then get those player perspectives.
Super glad to hear that. Yeah, so it's a really educational podcast. You can check it out. We go over all tons of 40K tactics and strategies from the best players in the world. We try to be all inclusive to geographical regions and tournament formats and try to bring you the whole show.
You got like a whole network over there too. I don't know if you want to, like the Unbroken. There's some really cool things that.
Oh yeah, Art of War's got a whole podcast network. This is the Art of War show that Paul and I do together. But we also have Art of War Unbroken, very similar format, part one, part two, where we get a guest on from a tournament. But instead of getting the winner, we get someone who goes 4-1 or 3-2, you know, close but not quite, and you know has maybe been in the scene a while or not, and is trying to learn about how to learn from their losses, how to analyze their games. That's a great show done by Blake Law and Brad Chester, two of our Art of War coaches. And then, of course, we've got Art of War Down Under, held by none other than the late, the great Adam Camilleri.
He's not late.
Well, if you ask Blake Law, he is from America. Right. And that show is basically a review show of all the different rules that come out in 40K, which at this point in time, there's quite a few. And you get some top players around the world to interview and basically subject matter experts on their factions to break down all these new rules and what they mean for the faction.
Yeah, and then if people have still not gotten enough of us by then we know we've been doing some commentary for Games Workshop.
Oh my God. Paul, how much Nick and Paul can the world take?
More Warhammer more often. That's all I'm saying. I'm happy we get to talk about it.
That's right. We go on twitch.tv/Warhammer. Paul and I are the official commentators for the Games Workshop US Open Series and maybe any other events they may do in the future. It's really awesome. We've been doing it for about a year now. And you know what? I'm honored to be in such a place in the community. It's so much fun getting to know all the players around the tournaments and talking to them and watching them play. It's been a blast.
Well, and there's three more events coming up this year where if people have not come to experience this yet, then, you know, there's a few more opportunities. We got Kansas City, Chicago, and then in New Mexico.
Oh, yeah. I can't wait for all of those, especially New Mexico is the finals, the finalists of the U.S. Open, Kansas and Chicago, and the ones that have happened, San Diego and Seattle. They actually qualify to go to New Mexico, all expenses paid by G-Dubs themselves, and it's a super awesome trip. But even if you don't qualify, that's totally okay. They have their own giant tournament at a 5-star resort.
Yeah, that's the most exciting thing. Well, I think it's cool. Is it like what I saw at San Diego was a bunch of families and stuff there. That was neat.
It's really interesting because you and I have been in the 40K scene for, you know, the end of time, basically, since it began. And it's getting so much more inclusive. You're seeing a lot more different kinds of people from all the different walks of life, families. It's so nice to see the inclusiveness in these 40K events and the culture scene shift.
Yeah, well, Nick, thanks for joining me. I wanted to bring people on in case they weren't aware of things of what we're doing and where to find us, because that's what I've gotten a lot of questions like on Instagram and Twitter. It's like, I've heard you mention these things, but I don't quite know where they are. Well, now you do. And now you know who we're
thanks
working
for having
with
me on. Check it out. We got the whole Art of War network, tons of competitive 40K content. We do our streaming. You can check me and Paul out anywhere.
We'll see y'all soon. Thanks, Nick.
You're listening to Forge the Narrative.
And we are back, everybody. Thanks for hanging out through that little enthusiastic plug we did a minute ago. Talk about all the cool things we're up to. And now
so
it's
like, wait. All of the things that you're up to? So did that segment take like an hour?
We were very brief.
So. Okay. Very brief, but excitable.
Gotcha. It's cool things happening, you know. I hope everybody can join in. And some of the live stuff, too. So that's what we're talking about. But I want to talk about Necrons. And while we got Red
snap
here. I know. No, Red, you've been our resident. You're our resident Khorne and Drukhari and Necron expert. And it's been a bit since we've been able to talk about Necrons. But now
I feel like there's a lot to unpack from just that statement.
Well, I think Necrons going to be like top of everybody's mind. If not this week, it'll be next week.
They should be. I mean, really, when you consider that they took progressively over time, the Necrons might consider it like overclocking for themselves. But really, it's just, okay, here are all these cool rules that you impose upon the Necrons to make it, right? Because the reason for rules is really, especially in this kind of setup in the game, you're trying to help engineer the system that makes you feel like you're playing Necrons to a certain extent. It's restrictions based upon the traits of the army, right? You're not arbitrarily prevented from doing something simply because, you know, it's a rule of the game, but more so because it's the army and what it's supposed to do and how it's supposed to do it and those kinds of things. And so when Necrons released years ago at this point with the release of ninth edition, you could tell that the rule designers were doing, I felt, a really good job in trying to create the mechanisms that made it feel like you were playing Necrons, with how things were based off of core, and not everything was core, a very specific number of things were core. And then also a lot of the buffs were balanced from how they came from the nobles specifically. It wasn't just any character, it was the nobles that gave protocols and how that played out. And then you had to play the protocols in a certain phased way. It had to go, you know, you selected them before the game, there was a certain way that they had to lay out, and then as they play out, you had to choose this or that, and how it went through your army phase, you know, turn by turn by turn. It was very cool. It very much felt like you were playing Necrons, which were this robotic entity that had this programming that was set up, and that it was all reliant on these characters who actually had more than just the mindless robot thing going on. They were these special characters whose personalities actually like enhanced the drones around them, which was really in the Necron feel. Unfortunately, at the same time, there was this other branch, this, we'll say, the second approach to ninth edition, where you had this army that literally 85% of it was core, and mm-hmm. it gained all the benefits, and it actually had something that with the, just one model, one individual character model, made the entire army almost as durable as the Necrons for other reasons, which was the Apothecary, by the way. And we're talking about Space Marines. And
I'm caught up now, thanks.
Yep, no problem, no problem. And so you could see where it's very clear that GW had these two approaches, and they very much went with the second approach for the additional armies as they built. And as it continued to come out, there was not, core was not nearly as restrictive for any other army as it was for Necrons. And of course, that changed with the first data slate, where so many things suddenly became core. And then even it's just continued to progress. It's been, it's like, in my opinion, the Necrons just went, we went from Necrons to Super Saiyan Necrons to Super Saiyan 2 Necrons. Like, yes. We have really gone to the next level, right? Like, we are about to, we can now defeat Perfect Cell, in my opinion.
You have torn me down so many times for mentioning stuff like Dragon Ball Z. I'm not going to let you get away with it and just be like, oh, I'm gonna call Adam a nerd and all this crap when he quotes anime and other dumb pop culture crap. And then here you are doing it perfectly, hidden all the time, in plain sight, you big old DBZ
nerd. That's how I get you. I was just like, talked for 5 minutes to just basically tell everybody to put Sonic King in the list and call it a day.
Dang, man. I tell you what, I mean, for 400 points, if we hadn't already talked about Abaddon being 300 points, he may be an auto-include in every Chaos list, but the Silent King at 400 points for what he is now, with the fact that he's a vehicle and now all Necron vehicles are core, which means that he gives himself his buffs and everything else buffs on top of that, and so on and so forth, because so many of the Necron things are oriented at core units. It is a massive, crazy, awesome change that I can't say that I'm not going to take him here in the near future, Paul.
But... totally agree. Despite your sass, I totally agree. I love where Necrons are at, man.
Look, it's an achievement. If you've bought a Silent King, you've assembled and you've painted a Silent King, then it is your reward to play him as often as possible.
That's right.
So what does a modern day Necron list look like? And I say modern day is like, again, been a lot of changes, been a lot of core. Is there is like an archetype when you're basically starting, like we said, every Chaos list will essentially be 1700 points plus Abaddon. Every Necron list is 1600 points plus the Silent King. How are you spending those 1600 points?
So yeah, there's a big thing to this where, and I hadn't really mentioned it, but the cool thing about protocols before was that it felt like you were playing Necrons through the protocols in certain ways. Like, that was a flavor piece, a mechanism they added, and I thought they did it very well. They did in the reverse engineering part of this, of releasing the restrictions of protocols, where now every turn you simply choose what protocol you want, given what dynastic trait you have, is massive. Because now you can choose, okay, well, I'm Mefrit, so I'm just going to choose the protocol of the whichever one is specific to Mefrit. I think it has something to do with voids and stars or whatever. It like I mean, you take that because Mefert gets both benefits, and you just do that every turn from here on out. And that means that you're always playing in Mefert's best protocol, which is huge. I mean, it really puts, and that's the crazy thing is that when you talk about, like, so here's the quote unquote meta build of Necrons, there, I would argue right now there is not, because the ability to actually access those protocols in such a way, whereas before, you know, we talk about, like, you know, there's the Nephrek, the Mefret, the Novok, so on and so forth, the Sawtek. Like, we used to joke around about there being, like, the OBSEC, right? Like, OBSEC being OBSEKH, spelled like the Necron version, which is, like, where you would take those custom traits so that you could move 6 inches and every single model is objective secured. That's a really cool combination. It has a lot of gameplay and in how we play. But the next part really being that if you take the other ones, the book dynasties, you're really able to tap into the protocols and just blow them out of the water, because you're able to pick one and just run with it the entire time. So I really feel like big winners out of this are Mefret and Novok. And I really don't want to discount the others, because they really can take advantage of what those other benefits are. The Nephrek one, right, is the ability to move further, but also be able to shoot and conduct actions. And so you can't discount the ability to conduct actions while also doing everything else you want to do. That's huge. The ability for Nihilok to be able to be more defensive, as well as conduct Overwatch with a better rate, or set it to defend so it hits better in combat. There's just a whole thing to what it does for that. And having that bonus to, if it hadn't moved, giving it an additional add to cover or to its armor save, kind of like almost like a mini armor of contempt. So it's not fair to just immediately discount those. But when you look at Novok and Mefret, the Novok being the melee oriented build and Mefret being the ranged build, those two things really spice up Necrons into the next level, in my opinion.
Totally agree. I think because you just, I'm right in saying that you get Hungry Void on Novok all game now, yeah? So the whole army is just extra rend on sixes and plus one strength.
That's
right. You're telling me you get that in addition to the pluses to advance and charge and all the other Novok bits. It's just like they got a super, super doctrine, essentially. And it's it's fantastic. I think it's a really elegant change by G-Dub, and one that totally supercharges at least Super Saiyan 2. You know, Super Saiyan 3, some crazy hair might be coming in the future.
I don't know the levels of the Saiyans that you're referring to.
Yes, you do. Don't lie.
I don't.
Don't lie. But anyways, it's okay. If you want to act like you don't, like, we got it. We get it. You got to play to the whole audience.
I'll be real with you. I tuned in for the Spirit Ball episode, and I'm like, I got to see this out.
13 episodes later.
Okay. Four episodes later, when he fired the Spirit Ball and then nothing happened, I turned it off and never looked back.
And I have to correct you for posterity's sake. It's a Spirit Bomb, not a Spirit Ball. Yeah, okay. Ball. But anyways, okay, Bomb. Come on now.
Okay,
anyways,
but like, half the episodes are just a recap of what happened before, so...
Well, that's why we watch it all on streaming, so you can just skip through that 10, okay? And we're still watching it now. It's not like we just watch it with our kids, okay?
Well, I only watch Dragon Ball Abridged now, if I'm going to watch it. Oh, it's so funny. I love that.
Are Necrons contenders now?
Absolutely. 100%. They are, especially between Armor of Contempt and what Necrons have available to them, the additional AP, they definitely throw into it. Between, again, Mefret or Novok are my two big, like, those are what I'm leaning towards. The next part being the Silent King brings more CP to the list, which is a big win, given the current restrictions.
That's what we're talking about. The first part of the show actually was characters that bring a CP advantage plus some extra abilities that basically, because those abilities exist, you don't have to pay for some advantages during the course of the game.
Right, exactly. And then there's some balance to it in regards that he costs 400 points. You have to take him as your warlord, but you also, like, it's actually in Nephilim, it's almost no point in buying his warlord trait, right? Because his warlord trait used to allow you to add in another protocol, but you don't need that anymore because you're just choosing what protocol you want. And so you just save yourself more CP in that regard. And then you use it if you really want to as a Necron player, because you bring a character who doesn't have a warlord trait built in, or they do, or what have you, but just outside of just the, you use the stratagem to buy that warlord trait for someone else, right? And so, like, you don't have to resort to buying. You're not just relatively wasting the Silent King's Warlord trait on buying it. You know, maybe they're looking at a possible change in the future for that. But either way, if they don't, I still think it's a pretty fair trade. The Codex comes with the ability to build into it anyways.
Well, I do like and dislike the fact that Necrons don't have incredible relics and Warlord traits to begin with. So it means usually you'll just start with more CP and get more juiced up from your stratagems. The only one I see in every list at the only auto take is the freaking Veil of Darkness. It's in every list.
But that's, yeah, that, again, we go back to my like argument about meta inception. That's what everybody thinks, right? I mean, there's the Warlord trait that is...
Is it the deny one?
Well, no. There's the Warlord trait that allows you to reroll charges, which is a big deal.
Oh, yeah, that's true. That is
right?
a big deal,
It's
yeah.
a huge one for Novoke. Mm. And you put it in the right place, and you can lock it in. I argue the Voltaic Staff is a step up in the light, like Staff of Light. That's a big one.
Yep.
Lots of damage comes out of that people really just don't see popping out from a character.
Was it minus one damage or half damage when you put it on the Catacomb Command Barge?
No, minus one damage is a big one. It's minus one damage. And so whether that's on a Command Barge or you put it on the like a Scorpec Lord or something like that, like it's... Putting on a Scorpec Lord allows you to also play that stratagem where he's minus one to wound, and he just soaks up a unit. You can throw him into a really tough unit, and he can just soak up damage.
Well, yeah, exactly right. But what I was getting at with that statement was you weren't like some other list where you always had your Ubiquitous, always had three Relics, always had three Warlord traits, because those players feel like they're having to just strip back, go back to a no-frills playstyle.
Oh, yeah.
Whereas
Absolutely.
Necrons are just like, hey, we're just kind of fine here. We had as many as we wanted already and had a bunch of CP. So
no points, no problem.
You guys losing, we're staying the same. This is great.
Well, and with that, so like the Cryptek Arcana have dropped in points to a certain degree. And so the ability to kind of tap that onto some of the different Crypteks that you have available, those are like free relics, right? And those are kind of upgrades that we see in other armies. So like Space Marines, it's like upgrading an apothecary or a chaplain or something like that. The Cryptex end up being the focal points where you can attach these different arcanas to them. And I think it's a really good way to kind of get around that where you don't need to necessarily. There's different combos in that I'd recommend people look at, but you don't have to focus on CP clearly, which I think is a really cool aspect to them. I agree. I mean, I do think the Necrons are going to go into a lot of games if you bring the Silent King with an alarming amount of CP compared to many other armies.
An alarming amount of CP.
A strong, there you go.
It's going to flip games.
Easy to paint. I shouldn't say easy to paint. Easy
Dang,
to get,
yeah, yeah.
Just easy to get table
all my
ready.
Necron efforts.
The minimum requirement is low, but the ceiling is like as crazy as you want to be.
Y'all are killing me.
Look, I don't mind calling them an accessible army.
Yeah, I think it's a strength.
Yeah, I do too. And you know, again, when we talk about you know what you're actually going to see in the tabletops, and this is all leading towards like that. We talk about hobby lag. This army could be tabletop ready, you know, quicker than let's say a Gene Stealer Cult army.
Paul, yeah, okay, yeah, sure. It's going to be better than Gene Stealer Cult because no one's going to build a Gene Stealer Cult.
It's like quicker,
unfortunately. Quick. Sure.
I just want to say I think it's great that Necrons can be easy to paint because they're not easy to build.
I was about to ask, Paul, I know you painted some. I saw them. They were awesome. I love the Mefrit design and everything. But did you build those?
I did. Yeah.
Yeah, so you know what I'm talking about. There's a big difference. And Tanya, you hit it on the head right there. Did you paint them or did you build and paint them? Because when we talk about accessible, I love the Necrons. They're great. And in fact, the new ones, especially the new ones out of the box that kind of like snap together and they all just kind of click is awesome. But I'm not going to discourage anybody. If you go out and you buy any of the older kits, you are in for a very exciting hobby challenge.
I just want to suggest, after I listened to my husband try to build some tomb blades, get yourself some forceps or really needle nose tweezers or something like that to help you put those together.
Save yourself
a lot of headache.
The little painting handle thing that you use, like to paint.
The assembly handle
for construction.
Yeah. I use that pretty frequently because it works. Like it's like plastic construction. You don't think it's as useful or as functional as it is, but it absolutely is. And sometimes it's really good when this is what I've done, you know, like a staff or whatever, and I've accidentally broken off the tip of it. And it's really kind of a pain to sit there and hold it until the glue cures. Those little hands sticking back on.
So I was hanging out when I was over there in Florida, and I was a little bit bored, and I was like, anybody got something that needs painting? I'm kind of bored. I'm just hanging around. And then Richard, one of the guys I was living with, just comes over and puts two packs of new flag ones on the table, and there was much regret. It's like, you'd help me with these. I'm like, yeah, sure, that'd be fine, man. Oh, they're a new kit. They can't be that bad. I'm like, oh, no.
I'm glad we kind of went over to the hobby stuff. Let's actually do a hobby segment. It's been a while since we had a true finishing moves segment. You know, finishing moves is a segment we do from time to time. It's a hobby segment where we talk about spending, you know, like 5 extra minutes on a model and really like jumping up the look of it, like how to get bang for your buck. And, you know, you thought the model was done, but there's sometimes you can do a little bit extra, and it only takes about 5 or so minutes. That's the concept of the fantasy moves. This time we're going to be talking about smoke and flame. I know we've kind of covered this in the past, but I don't know if we talked about specifically smoke and how to get that effect on a miniature.
Yeah, it's kind of I think off screen, Tanya was talking about how it's a counterintuitive painting style. It's so many other shapes and miniatures you're told to, as the further you go out from the shape, the lighter the color should be, you know, getting towards your highlights, your focal points. And then you got to kind of flip the script. I don't know if you guys can break it down better than I can.
I can remember the very first time that I tried to paint smoke. It was actually on Boba Fett for Star Wars Legion. I was painting it for a friend, and very like dynamic model. But his jetpack had these like little smoke kind of details on the back. And I kept painting them like how I painted the model, you know, like you've got your darker base coat and then a wash and then you layer highlight or dry brush up the brighter colors. And I was like, why does this not look right? Like this looks really, really bad. So then
it didn't look natural to the eyes is what you probably, yeah.
Yeah. So I'm not the kind of person that goes to a tutorial because apparently I just like to do it the hard way. So I actually went to some reference photos, and then I noticed that on like the inside of both flames and smoke, the inside is lighter than the outside. So as you get farther away from the source of the smoke or the fire, it gets actually darker. So on that Boba Fett, I painted those details white, and then I just dry brushed on a couple layers of gray, like one light gray and then a darker gray. And it looked so good, and it looked so real, and I was quite proud of myself. Gave myself a little pat on the back for that one.
Nice.
Yeah.
With this type of effect, it gets darker as you move away from the source. Mm-hmm. And so you kind of think, like, the same thing. Well, I'm going to paint this model the exact same up. I'm going to put my, you know, my final dry brush of white, you know, whatever, across the whole thing or whatever. And that is quite – it's the opposite. Now, look, when you're painting – we're painting space miniatures, you know, or fantasy stuff or whatever. You can do it however you want. But if you want to go like natural, and even if you're doing like, what's that orc shaman that has the like the tiki head on the top of a staff, or I can't remember the name of the model, but it's a Sigmar model that I've co-opted into Warhammer 40K for our weird boy.
He's in the Bone Splitters, right?
It's
Iron Jaws, I think, is the one you're talking about.
I think it's the Iron Jaws one, yeah. Well, it, you know, billowing smoke out of that thing, and I painted that smoke purple. Same concept applies. You whatever color you're choosing to go with it, for it to look a little bit more realistic, even though it's space smoke, it'd be darker on the outside.
Mm-hmm. With my Night Haunt, there's actually quite a bit of like spooky, ghostly smoke. There's lots of candles and like candelabras and things like that. And for all of the smoke on them, I'm doing the same thing, except I'm starting off with white and then I'm going up the gradients till I get to rust gray. So it's kind of like a blue gray kind mm-hmm. of thing, but it's the exact same. You start with the light and then you slowly build up the colors till you get to the shade that you want. It works for all colors. So if you want to do it for flames, you just start with white and then you add yellows, oranges, and reds sort of in that in that order.
Kind of like the tutorials you'll see where they tell you how to paint like a bone or a tusk coming out of somebody's forehead for chaos or whatever, is that they also have you darken it towards the tip. Because I guess, and I'm not a veterinarian, or whatever, but I guess in nature, like the longer the horn or whatever also gets darker towards the tips of it.
It's just older, right? I think.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. But
you can layer this, you can dry brush it. There's many ways that you could do it, and the sort of concept stays the same. So it's something that's easy to play around with, and it gives you a good effect both ways of
doing it. Yeah, if you're doing it with a wash, you just don't pull the wash all the way down to the bottom of the bit, whatever it is you're painting. You don't do it all over. You can stop halfway and kind of feather it towards the bottom.
I'll admit, I know it's on Warhammer Plus right now, you know, like if you had the app, Adam. But, oh, ding, bingo card, next.
Yeah,
so if the Warhammer Plus has all the like collection of all the different GW like hobby session things, which are really cool. But the other thing I did is that as GW actually released all those different videos, like that Duncan Rhodes and that guy named Pinky did, I used to like save those, like bookmark them. And actually Fire was one that I really went back for. Specifically for someone like randomly out of the blue, I was flattered, asked me to paint an Abaddon for them, right? And if I've said it before, I'll say it again. I really don't feel like I'm that good of a painter, but I did paint this Abaddon and I tried as hard as I could. And going into it, I did some preparation and I had to go to this like hobby video that is now on the app that Adam doesn't use. But the I went into this. It was very helpful looking at it. And just like you said, it was this counterintuitive process of almost like painting it backwards. And it was extremely helpful. And it really actually came out way better than I thought it would, just because I didn't think I was going to do that well at it. But after a few test runs, it went really well. And so I highly recommend folks check that out.
These are things that we talk about, just ways to get to step up your miniatures. And it's very accessible. And it's not about looking at the whole model and painting. Like Abaddon or Gilliman, very incredibly intimidating models. But if you break it down, and I'm just using them as an example, this could be any model, you break it down into its component parts, then it starts to feel a little bit more accessible. Like I'll admit, like when I'm painting a Space Marine, or my Blood Angels are probably not the best example, because I get super basic with their bolters. It's like it's just a black casing, and the metal bits are lead belcher, and it gets a wash or whatever. But like on a Plague Marine, where I feel like I'm already spending, you know, a decent amount of time painting all the other stuff on there, it's really easy for me to decide to kind of skimp out on the bolter casing. But then when you convince yourself that it just looks so much better if you paint it the red to offset the green or whatever, and then coming up with a way that's repeatable, a way to actually paint that across your entire army and not have it kind of talk yourself out of doing it, then you get more work done, I think. You get more productivity. Because motivation is not something that everybody has all the time, but a system, you know, or whatever, something can carry you a lot farther. And so breaking these down into actual like things that you can do, I think helps get models on the table more often. And what does that
get? I agree.
Hopefully it lets do. Hopefully let's play more often. So that's we haven't really given the concept of what the finishing moves is or why we talk about it in a little bit. So maybe this will help us get more of these tips out there at the end of every show.
So conceptually, what do you think the best? So I'll tell you how I usually do flames, and I usually I'll do as many different layers of as if we do it. Let's just do red flames. I'll start with sometimes I'll start with a little bit of white, and then I'll work from white to yellow, and then yellow and just start mixing reds into my yellow to go through orange. Mm-hmm. And that's if I want to go absolutely nuts. And usually that'll be, you know, it sounds like it's going to be 20 layers, but usually it's like 6 or 7.
Dude, you go all the way up to black, and even then it's still 6 or 7.
Yeah. And then I'll hit it with a glaze, and I'll blend all the reds and oranges together, and also it'll hit the white that I've got as well. And so by default, the white will be the lightest and the focal point. So when you look at the flame, the white's the piece that the white dot at the middle of the flame is a bit that hits your eye. But then how far do you guys go with the – do you go from – and then do the reverse at the midpoint from the black to the through the grays to white? Do you finish it white at both ends?
No, you got to be black. You got to be super dark at the tips. Now, I mean, really, you can even go so far as to, after you do everything you just said, including if you, even if you do decide to kind of, well, one, I don't want to lose sight of the fact that this is space fire and you can do whatever you want. And it doesn't have to burn the same way. You know, Geller fields could be at play here. Nobody knows the origin of the flame that is emitting from whatever it is you're painting. But after you did everything you just did, you could be bold enough to do a very light dry brush of black across the very tips.
Mm-hmm.
And it's as good as done. You've now brought it back to natural, and people they will look at it and go, that is what I expect to see.
I don't really have it set up like I do it the same every single time. Mm-hmm. I just sort of use the general idea of starting at white and ending at the darker color. So sometimes I'll dry brush, sometimes I will glaze, and sometimes I do different colors, but the way that I look at it is not every flame, even if it's like just a regular orange flame, not every flame is going to burn the same way. Like sometimes it'll be more hot, so it'll burn more white, you know, sometimes it'll be more cool, it'll burn more red. So I think that you really have a lot of license to make an artistic statement with flame, right? To choose an ending color that sort of complements what you have going on. I think flame is very fun to play with in that way.
I like what you brought up there is making it, you know, because you're this element on the model, you are trying to add some contrast, or it's an opportunity to add some contrast, a point of interest or focus for the thing. And same color theory applies. Like if you got a green model, red flame, but if you got a red model, you know, not red flame.
And flames burn all sorts of colors, right? Like I believe it's the carbon in whatever we burn on our planet that makes flames red.
Whoa, science.
But if it's any other sort of element that is being burned, it's going to change the color of the flame. You literally have the artistic license to do whatever you want with this. You can pick any color and play with it, and I encourage people to do so. I'm painting a miniature right now. It's for just a little like narrative skirmish game, and I'm going to paint the flame that this guy's holding in his hand. I'm going to paint it pink. And you have the license to do that if you like.
Which miniature's got the best flames on it?
Oh,
what do we reckon? I know my pick.
The Dark Apostle.
Yeah?
Yeah, doesn't he have like that like brazier or whatever on his back?
Yeah, oh, yeah. Not only does he have like the fire, but he also has like the blood dripping from it too.
Yeah. That model is amazing.
Oh, that's the book, right? That he's holding in his arm. Yeah. He's got like the three braziers, and then he's got books on fire. That's cool.
And his little buddies or whatever.
Yeah, his buddies too. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mine was going to be the fire belly from Ogres, because I felt like it had the biggest flame, so you got the most. You got to do the most with it. But I like the Dark Apostle better. I didn't even think of it.
That Dark Apostle has like dripping blood fire.
Yeah,
and
it's so metal.
I gotta go with Gilliman, and I hate to say that.
Oh, boring.
Yes, the Emperor's sword. It's on fire. It's amazing. We've all wanted that sword. We've all pretended we've had that sword.
Red, how excited are you that I picked a Chaos Space Marine model, though?
I mean, that was a really good choice. I was thinking something along those lines, too. I was trying to think, you know, I really like it's the, cause I'm with you. I think that was one that really stuck out, cause it's all came out in this range that GW, I think, was really playing with that. Cause Abaddon, Gilliman, okay, Paul, fine, has like, you know, the fire effects to it. But then you look at some of these other models and the Dark Apostle. And at the same time, that Sister's model dropped where she has that fire in the background, like on the base. It's almost like that's probably some of the most dynamic fire that I've seen in like the action pose. It's like you can't tell if the fire is because she's just so badass that it like kicked up while she was like spinning to shoot that pistol or something, or if it's, which is not the case, it just looks that awesome, or if it's like, you know, she's on this in this area where there's this ongoing battle and the fire's raging and there's just bits of fire around her. I think that's probably my favorite, all in all.
Very nice.
My favorite model that I have is an old metal one. It's the Ministorum Priest for Guard, where he's like, he's like yelling out of the book or whatever, and he's
got this giant.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite flames that I ever painted. It turned out so good.
That's a cool segment. Well, that's a great place to wrap it up. Appreciate everybody listening and hanging out. Please don't forget to leave some 5-star reviews. Hit the subscribe if you haven't already. And this is a weekly show we do.
See ya.
We'll be back next week.
Bye, everybody.
They said, but I already subscribed. You better do it too.